Pacifica Radio. This is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. In Oregon on KYAQ on the Central Coast and Queso in Cottage Grove. Lancaster, Pennsylvania's WLRI. Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. Columbus, Ohio's WGRN. Palinville, New York's WLPP. Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR. New Orleans, WHIV. Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. Seattle, Washington, High Seattle, KODX. KFOI in Red Bluff and Redding, California. KKRN in Round Mountain, CA. And Minneapolis, St. Paul's, AM 950 KTNF. And coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the internets, the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. As usually hosted by Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com, but Brad and Desi have time off. You have me. I'm Angie Cuero sitting in for you today, and once again on our next show, I'm the host of In Deep with Angie Cuero, heard on many of these same stations and streams. I'll tell you, it is scary around here right now. I live a full 4 hours south of the fire in Redding, one of a couple or three blazes in California right now, and clear down here, 4 hours away, the sky is hazy, the gunk in the air catches in your throat. I woke up today, in fact, thinking that I had a cold. But no, it's the fire stuff in the air. And the pictures out of Northern California are absolutely apocalyptic. It's hellfire. It's actually jumped the Sacramento River. This is the car fire, has jumped the Sacramento River. That's not a small jump. And as I speak now, two people are already dead, one firefighter, one bulldozer operator. Houses are blazing to the ground. I see this happening, and I want to smack every industry-funded or just plain ignorant climate denier and legislator full in the face. People are dying. Lives are being ruined right now, right this very moment, by the dollar signs in those people's eyes. This is on you, guys. In a few minutes, we're going to have a conversation with wildfire expert Gary Ferguson, but we check out some other headlines first. Wouldn't it be amazing if a Trump, any Trump, celebrated ostensibly good news without kicking somebody else in the teeth? With a lie, no less? So the economy has grown just over 4% in the last quarter. The Trump in the White House did promise that market growth would pay for his tax cut package. Let's put aside the fact that, as any economist will tell you, and as plenty of economists told us during the Obama years, market growth can only be tangentially and inconclusively tied to whoever's in office at the moment. Really. So let's just put that aside. Mini Trump, Trump Jr., promptly tweeted out, "Just because Obama never broke 2% doesn't mean someone with great policies can't. Let's keep this going." For God's sake. What about pretending just for a moment that if you really think this is good news that benefits all Americans? Hold that thought for just a moment, by the way. How about just pretending you're happy for everybody? What sociopathy runs genetically from Daddy Trump to Baby Trump that dictates that defecation on someone else has to be incorporated into every single utterance or tweet? Okay, let's break the rest of his tweet down, shall we? Obama never broke 2%. Well, actually, the markets under Obama broke 2% in multiple quarters, including third quarter of 2014 at 5.2%. Doesn't matter. When you have spent years inoculating your troops against facts, they're not going to notice that not only are you wrong, you are spectacularly wrong. Then there's the issue of who really gets the goodies from the tax cuts and the market growth. Check this out from The Guardian UK. Quote, "It's still too early to gauge the ultimate impact of tax cuts, but there are worrying signs that the package meant to spur investment and hiring has instead gone straight into the pockets of investors. Economists warn the growth spurt may be unsustainable. The evidence so far is the benefits of the mini boom have disproportionately gone to the wealthiest Americans. The last time the economy expanded at a comparable pace was in 2014, when growth hit 5.2% in the third quarter. Now the latter part of Junior's tweet, let's keep this going? Okay, it's pretty much a given that Trump will continue efforts to line the pockets of the rich, but back to The Guardian for this, it's still too early to gauge the ultimate impact of the tax cuts. There are worrying signs that the package meant to spur investment and hiring has gone straight into the pockets of investors. In May, American companies announced a record $201 billion in stock buybacks where companies buy their own shares in order to boost the share price. S&P 500 companies are set to repurchase as much as $800 billion in stock this year, a new record. But the majority of the benefit of those buybacks will go to the richest Americans. In the meantime, wage growth has continued lackluster, continued unabated since the end of the recession, and so far has been unaffected by the Trump presidency. Bottom line in the article is summed up by Josh Bivens of the Economic Policy Institute. He points out tax cuts have provided a bit of stimulus, particularly for people who own a lot of stock and are paying less, but low wages are still the biggest puzzle in this economy. Not the people Trump and Trump Jr. care about, so who cares? Also, genetic is this whole conducting the business of the people in 280 characters or fewer on Twitter. That is where you can follow most of the bickering over whether Big Trump knew about Little Trump's 2016 meetings with Russians to get the dirt on Hillary Clinton and torque the election. I'm not even going to quote the tweets from the White House. Insert misplaced capitals, the words witch hunt, crooked Hillary, collusion, fake news here, and you get the gist. Michael Cohen, though, as reported by both CNN and NBC, says, Big Trump did know, and even more, approved the meetings himself. Excellent piece from Charlie Pierce at Esquire on all this. It's called If Cohen is Telling the Truth, That Ought to Be the Ballgame. A bit of that. He says, we stand as a self-governing republic at a stark, unclouded moment. Either you believe the president of the United States is utterly illegitimate, having conspired with a hostile power to gain the office he now holds, and that every act he has taken in that office, up to and including swearing the oath of office, is equally illegitimate, or you do not. It is now a binary, he says. If Cohen is willing to testify to that effect, then the president, asterisk, conspired with the regime of Vladimir Putin in order to gain control over the executive branch of government in this country, which not only includes the military, but the law enforcement and intelligence apparatus as well. He goes on to draw connections here between now and the era of Watergate. Check that out. Charles Pierce in Esquire. Facebook is eternally in the news. Yesterday was, this one's going to go down in history, an incredible walloping in the stock market, a 19% drop, actually between 19 and 20, if you look at the small print, $120 billion in shareholder wealth up in smoke. Now, it wasn't just the lukewarm second quarter report that Facebook put out. It was the warning to essentially expect more of the same. Facebook's hand is finally being forced to clean up security and privacy issues, and that means a cut in profits. Now, Facebook's press continues to suck, too. They have just taken it in the shorts over Alex Jones, making shooting motions at an imaginary Robert Mueller on screen, and the continued insistence that Sandy Hook was faked. More on that later. They're in the news having suspended Jones, but read the fine print again. That is not the InfoWars channel that has been suspended. It's his personal account. InfoWars channel is still up and running. I don't know if you caught this. This ran from Channel 4 in Britain earlier this month, and it's kind of important in this context. There's a show called Dispatches on Channel 4 in Britain. Inside Facebook, Secrets of the Social Network is a series that they have been running, and in addition to other things that they have discovered, is something called Shielded Review. And you know, theoretically, there are violations that if you make them and if they accumulate enough, you get smacked down by Facebook. Check this out. Our undercover reporter is told if any page is found to have five or more pieces of content in violation of Facebook's rules, the entire page should be taken down in accordance with the company's policies. But we being Channel 4, have discovered that posts on Facebook's most popular pages with the highest number of followers cannot be deleted by ordinary content moderators. Instead, they're referred to the shielded review queue, the secret room, where they can be directly assessed by Facebook rather than the staff that it's normally handed out to. These pages include those belonging to jailed former English Defense League leader Tommy Robinson, with over 900,000 followers, given the same protected status as government and news organizations. Very, very, very far to the right, in case you don't follow British politics. A moderator tells the undercover reporter the far-right group Britain's First pages were left up despite repeatedly featuring content that breached Facebook's guidelines because, quote, they have a lot of followers, so they're generating a lot of revenue for Facebook. The Britain First Facebook page, again, far right, was finally deleted in March 2018. What did it take? The arrest of the deputy leader of Britain First. Facebook confirmed to dispatchers they do have special procedures for popular and high-profile pages, including Tommy Robinson and including Britain First. Oh, well, they've renamed Shielded Review. Now they call it Crosscheck. That makes a great deal of difference. Check out Channel 4 Dispatches. You'll find it online. There's a lot going on behind the scenes in Facebook. Violent content, such as graphic images and video of assaults on children, remaining on the site, despite being flagged by multiple users as inappropriate. Thousands of reported posts remaining unmoderated on the site while Channel 4 was filming, beyond Facebook's stated aim of a 24-hour turnaround, including posts relating to suicide threats and self-harm. There's a lot more. And there's more coming on Facebook later this hour, so I don't want to make it entirely the Bash Facebook hour. So we have a lot more to hear about as well, including those wildfires in California. A report on what's the latest going on with Repro Justice. I do want to share some good news with you, okay? I mean, what the heck? There are a couple good news stories in the news, and I'll bring you one later. Right now, I'll bring you this one. A jury who saw through the idiocy in Georgia. There's a guy who was accused of having medicinal marijuana. He faced a felony charge of growing marijuana for his own personal medicinal use. This was reported in Raw Story. His name is Giovanni McCoy, and he was caught with nearly a pound of marijuana. And he told the police, yep, it's mine. It's my medicine. Now, the jurors heard all this, and what did they do? They let him go. It was not that they let him go because they didn't think it was his. They didn't let him go because he denied the charges. He owned it. He said, yeah, that's mine. That's my medicine. And what did the jurors have to say about that? They told the Atlanta Constitution, quote, he was believable. He wasn't trying to make money. He had it to ease his health. A juror said, a lot of us said, he wasn't bothering anybody. Finally, juror Brian Lloyd suggested, sometimes good things happen to good people. Sanity in our judicial system. More good news coming up in a few moments. I'm Angie Curl. Stick around. This is the Bradcast. It's the Bradcast. I'm Angie Cuero. Talked earlier about the wildfires that we're seeing, well, on my side of the planet. We're seeing them here in Northern California. Yosemite is shut down to an extent never seen in its history, and we're seeing way too close to home the fires up in Redding, California, with destroyed homes. Unfortunately, at last report, two fatalities. One of the important things to understand about this is fire in a character and style that we not only haven't seen before up until now, but that we'd better get used to. A sad thing to say, but Gary Ferguson has made a living out of studying this. I spoke to him in an earlier program that I will link from the website on indeepradio.com. Gary, it's really good to have you back. Tell me about, as you watch with your practiced eye, as you watch the nature of these fires evolving at Yosemite and in Redding. What characteristics are you seeing that alarm you and tell you that these do, in fact, fit the pattern of climate-impacted fire?
Well, first of all, they're heartbreaking, and my great best wishes and sympathies go out to those who are struggling against these just terrific forces of nature. They do, as you suggest, fit an emerging pattern, so-called megafires, which used to be actually quite rare even 20 or 30 years ago, and since about 2000. We've had over a dozen years with at least a dozen megafires, and those are defined by fires of over 100,000 acres. They're burning hotter, they're burning longer, and of course, they're threatening more structures and more lives, both of residents and firefighters. A couple things are going on. One is we're reaping the harvest of a set of well-intentioned but bad decisions in early to mid 20th century, where we really had decided that fire was bad, was our enemy, and we would put fire out wherever it happened. And in the American West, what we really did was shut down a force of nature that's extremely important to get rid of the fuel load, if you will, that accumulates in arid forests. So by eliminating those, that fuel load just continued to build up. And after the big 1988 fires in Yellowstone, a lot of scientists and fire ecologists started thinking, wow, we've made a terrible mistake, and we need to go in and try to do prescribed burns and other sorts of things to reduce this fuel load. But, Angie, what's really making that particular problem far, far worse is climate change. We've got much drier forests than we have had in the past. The wind events, because of energy in the atmosphere caused by climate change, is much more severe, which, of course, is part of the problem going on in Redding right now, to have those ferocious winds coming from all different directions, some of them generated by the fire itself, but some of them, you know, again, generated by the fact that we live in a windier world right now, and this is also going on in Greece as we speak. So we've got those twin hits, basically, of having an excessive fuel load with a very rapidly changing climate that's drier, and the fire seasons are much longer. They've grown by about 12 weeks since 1975, and that's a profound change.
That's a huge number. That's a really daunting number. What are the fire teams learning about how to fight these? And correct me if I'm wrong. I get the feeling that their firefighting methods can't evolve as quickly as the fire situations are.
I think that's very true. You know, we think that if we throw enough firefighting technology and expertise, and we really do have a lot of both, at a fire, we should be able to stop it. But that's just not true. When the conditions reach a certain point, which they are in Redding right now, all the firefighters can do is basically help people stay safe, help evacuations happen, and then do some structure protection. Now, one of the things that is emerging very rapidly in the West, our communities are really finally starting to get serious with fire. I wouldn't say fireproofing, but making their neighborhoods and subdivisions more resistant to wildfire when it comes through. Most houses tend to burn not from a wall of flames, although there certainly are fires that do that, but from embers rising from the fire maybe a mile or two away and then landing on the roof or in the yard beside the house. So there are some very simple things that people can do to kind of fire protect their homes. At this point, only about 3% of 20,000 communities that are in this kind of what's called a wildland-urban interface, where there's a high chance of wildfire, only about 3% of the communities have taken those steps. But I think because of what we're seeing, a lot more communities will be embracing those measures, and that will help some. That will help some. The firefighters are able to get a better sense right now, because of technology, of where the winds are coming from, down to individual drainages, what might be going on in individual drainages, fuel moisture loads. They're kept up to speed almost instantaneously from these various satellite assists that they've got going on. So they know what's going on, but knowing what's going on and stopping it are two different things. Mostly what the firefighters are able to do in a fire situation like what's going on in Redding is to keep themselves safe, and that's that's no small thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, one of the reasons I thought of you this morning, I went outside and the air here in the San Francisco Bay Area is hazy because of what's happening up north of us. And it seemed almost bizarre to be doing something as mundane as watering my tomatoes. But doing what you have recommended, I mean, I looked at the outside of my house and it's like, look, there are dead cedar branches right against the base of the house. There's dead ivy over in the arbor. All of this needs to be dealt with. So I appreciate your putting that out there. It's overwhelming in its size, but there is stuff that individual people and individual neighborhoods can do.
Yes, yes. And you just suggested a great one is clear a perimeter of 8 to 10 feet around the house where there is nothing burnable. Make sure your gutters are clean and not full of dried leaves and pine needles. It's actually quite smart to put a fine screen mesh over vent openings in the attic or crawl spaces because embers can actually get sucked in to the house. If you've got a tree that 30 or 40 feet away that has shrubbery and smaller trees under it, what those smaller plants can do is serve as a ladder to allow a fire that did come through to climb up into the tree itself. And of course, that's a bigger flame, all the more potential to send embers into the house. So cleaning up that under story, if you will, under your bigger trees is another thing that people can do. So there are things, and they don't sound like they're all that remarkable, but they make a tremendous difference. There have been fires where those subdivisions that have put those sorts of measures into place, out of 65 or 70 homes, maybe they lose three or four compared to a subdivision right next door that did nothing, and they're losing 62, 63 homes out of 70 or 75. So it just makes a phenomenal difference.
Gary Ferguson's book is Land on Fire, The New Reality of Wildfire and the Rest. Gary, it feels odd to say it about an important book that has some grim news, but some encouragement as well. It's in fact a very beautiful book. The photography, you know, makes it well worthwhile as well. And I know you kind of crammed me in here into your schedule, and I really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. And, you know, this is kind of a sobering year for everyone in California, Angie. I believe that we're still on track in that area to have a fire season last every month of the year. So 2018, if that's true, and it looks like it will be, it'll be the first year in history where there's been a fire danger, a fire risk every single month of the year. And that is a solid pointer to climate change. And we really need to get awfully serious about what we do in the future to try to moderate the effects of the environment warming and drying.
Gary, so much important information. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Angie.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. So I know all this conversation with Gary about fire sounds very West Coast-centric, even California-centric. And in the sense that, yeah, we're the states most inclined to burn to the ground, that's a fair thought. But Gary visited me at InDeep, my own show, last year. And we had time then to go into how this affects everybody. I mean, if you're paying taxes, yeah, the fires are here. But the money to fight them comes from across the country. And that is a bucket that isn't getting any deeper as the fires are spreading more widely. Talk about how all of this gets paid for and where that falls apart, especially because, you know, fires are increasing. We're not going to have a non-fire season anymore. How does one go about budgeting for this, and where does that put the U.S. Forest Service?
Oh, it's a great question. And the Forest Service, as far as federal agencies, has been, continues to be, as it started out, claiming it should be the principal agency that fights fires. But the BLM does, certainly state agencies do, Park Service does. But the Forest Service has found itself in a situation where, increasingly, it's stealing money from its other programs in order to fight fires. There have been, years where 70 and 80% of the budget, the Forest Service budget, has gone to fighting fires, when 30 years ago it would have been about 15%. The problem with that is as you take all the money out of other programs that the Forest Service has and put it all in actual fighting, which makes sense. If there's a fire threatening a community, you're going to put everything you have into it. But the problem is those prescriptive burns I talked about earlier, the thinning operations that could do so much to reduce the danger to communities, that money, and those projects are often launched and managed by the Forest Service, isn't there. So it's a crisis management system. And one of the things that would change that utterly And there's been a House bill, I think it's 167, now for 3 years sitting in Congress with no action to allow the Forest Service to access emergency money, much like FEMA comes in when a hurricane or severe flooding is underway. They don't have that through yet. But at the point they did, then they could at least access federal dollars and not eliminate the very programs that would keep the future fire seasons from being so devastating.
Someone in the audience is asking about logging after a fire, and this actually ties in with some changes that you've been following with the wood industry trying to focus on the use of saplings and thinner trees.
Yes.
So that the larger trees can grow healthy. Talk about that a little bit.
You know, logging absolutely has its place. It certainly does. And to be able to log after a fire, if it's economically feasible, if the fire's in a remote place where there aren't any roads, the cost of building roads into places that have, let's say, small dimensional timber makes very little sense. And you're not going to helicopter log small dimensional timber. That makes no economic sense either. But in those cases and in those places where it does make sense, that kind of logging is good. And what has kept it from being reasonable in the past is there have been very few, and there still are actually, very few mills that can actually handle that dimensional lumber. And so there's an entire infrastructure that needs to be created, and we would do well to invest and put incentives, financial incentives, into developing that. Now, in Portland, there, as well as in Western Montana, they're starting to borrow some lessons from some of the Northern European countries, and they're using that small dimensional timber to make cross-laminate beams. Those cross-laminate beams are so strong, they're essentially chipped wood that are glued. It's not exactly plywood. They have tremendous fire ratings. 3- and 4-story buildings are being built in downtown Portland right now entirely of these cross-laminate wood beams. That's the kind of market that will make that sort of thinning ahead of a fire or, to some degree, harvesting small dimensional lumber after or timber after a fire make sense. But you've got to have that economic infrastructure in place for that to happen. Now, since you mentioned logging, I have heard several people suggest that it's because we stopped logging so severely as we were doing in the 70s that the fire danger is so high. That's not necessarily true. Large clear cuts have the effect of creating what are called even age stands. If you have a 1,000-acre clear cut, all the trees that come back are usually going to be a monoculture of one tree. They're going to get started at the same time, and they're going to grow at the same rate. This is exactly that homogeneous even age stand is the choice feast for pine bark beetles. They love that. And of course, that creates, again, as we saw earlier, its own set of troubles. So logging can be very good, but it's not a panacea, and we are not in the current dire situation we're in right now, in my humble opinion, because we stopped massive clear-cut logging. That's really not what's going on here. We have other issues that we need to address.
Mm-hmm. When a fire has run through an area, a lot of the stuff that had been growing there in decades, Pat, could no longer really be supported. It's already drought-stressed to begin with.
Yes.
It's not going to find a habitable, nice place to grow up again. What's the nature of the stuff that grows anew in these places? You mentioned in the book Loosestrife, which takes over, and that's invasive. It has all kinds of problems. Do we see a positive side to maybe something coming up new in a fire area that's better suited for our new conditions?
If those new things that come up have been adapted, if they're native plants to this area, that can be a very good thing. If they're invasives, so-called invasives from Eurasia, spotted loosestrife, knapweed, certainly cheatgrass. We have 100 million acres of cheatgrass now. Cheatgrass has absolutely invaded and taken over post-burned areas that normally would have been occupied by native grasses. It's much better at getting started right after a fire. It grows for a very short amount of time in a green state, and then it turns brown and dries out. And there are places where if you drop a match in cheatgrass, it's like throwing a match into flash paper. It's unbelievable. And so the cheatgrass communities are carrying fires into places where they've never been before, including desert areas of the Southwest. The other thing that we're seeing as far as vegetation coming back or not coming back, that which does come back will be richer because all of the nutrients, again, that were in the biomass are back in the soil. The elk that were grazing in Yellowstone after those fires were eating grass that was 20% richer in protein than pre-fire. So fabulous for a fire to go through. But the problem is these big mega fires can actually cause sterilization of the soil. There are some places, because of the heat, the 2200 degree heat for prolonged periods of time, places near Colorado Springs where they've had fires 15 or 20 years ago, very, very little regeneration. The normal regeneration of the forest is not happening the way it used to. Climate change, again, is a bit of a culprit. There was a study released last week based on 1,500 sites in the Rocky Mountains that showed that the forest in general, post-fire, is not coming back as quickly because of climate change.
Gary Ferguson visiting me on In Deep. His book is Land on Fire. Let's go overseas for this next story. One of the things I love about sitting in for Brad and Desi is they put a priority on news that you may miss, the important stuff that just gets buried under the louder headlines. An example, therevelator.org has a story out about how dangerous it is, especially in Brazil and the Philippines, to be an environmental activist. Now, here in the States, environmental activism does put you up against very deep-pocketed financial interests. Oil and gas companies, agribusiness developers, but on the whole, you're not going to lose your life protesting on behalf of the environment in America or taking other activist measures. You're probably going to live through it. The people who are trying to save wildlife by curbing the palm oil industry or working against water privatization overseas are, in fact, engaging in life-threatening work. There's a piece up right now at Revelator.org by the site's editor, and the author of the ongoing Extinction Countdown column. He's John R. Platt. And here's a quick editorial note before you hear our interview. Kind of funny. As I was setting up the interview with him, I told him I was triple and double checking all the systems. And right after I got off the phone with him, one of my systems crashed and ate my part of the conversation. Anyway, it was retrievable, but for the sake of your ears, I want to warn you, it does sound a little bit off on my side. Lots of valuable info, though. So here's our conversation. John, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
I don't know that everyone who's listening knows about The Revelator, so why don't you acquaint us there?
Sure. We've been around about a year. We're a news site covering environmental issues ranging from endangered species to climate change to public lands, clean water. And kind of like the broadcast, we try to cover stories that other people aren't talking about. There's an awful lot of important environmental issues that slip through the cracks, and we considered our goal to try to fill those cracks and try to give people the context they need to make sense of these things.
Mm-hmm.
So we cover news, we have an investigation side, and we also cover ideas. We run essays and op-eds from a variety of people around the world.
That latter part is one thing I'm glad to hear around the world. It's understandable that so much of our news is America-centric. This is the kind of thing that goes missing. So I want to dive right into that and talk about what's a global witness data release that your article cites. One of the things that stood out to me is that merely trying to get a count of how dangerous and how many people are affected is very difficult. We're focusing on data that came out for 2017, and Global Witness originally said 197 people were murdered in 2017 who were doing activism, environmental activism. And then since then, the organization has come up with 10 more murders. The original figure is horrible enough. What
right.
is it, to your knowledge, that goes into the difficulty in getting a count here, in getting a complete picture?
Well, first of all, it is all around the world, and a lot of it is in really remote places. And quite frankly, a lot of these crimes are covered up. Either the governments or corporations themselves are hiding their actions. A lot of cases, these crimes are committed by government security forces. Other times, people are just too intimidated to come to light, to make people aware of what's going on with them. And that's the whole other thing about this. People are being murdered to stop their activism, but it's also a signal to everyone else, shut up or something's going to happen to you too.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, you start your article out with Hernan Bedoya, and this is a murder that occurred in 2017. And he was out there in one of the ongoing environmental battles, and that's trying to tackle the palm oil industry. despite as much notice as has gone out about the palm oil industry and how many people in America have tried to get that word out there, I still think people don't understand palm oil is not only in just about every foodstuff in America, but it's a specific threat to very specific animals. The orangutans, for example, their lives are being impacted directly.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is that, yeah, if people know about palm oil, they probably know that it's impacting the orangutan. But there's so many other wildlife species in Indonesia. But now palm oil is being grown all around the world, in Africa, in South America. So the same problems of deforestation and habitat loss and direct assaults and slayings of animals and people that we had in Indonesia is now happening in our hemisphere.
Mm-hmm. Your article goes into some of the intimidation that goes on. You've already mentioned that the murders themselves are intimidation by their very nature. What other mechanisms are used to try to either shut down or intimidate the environmental activists?
Sure. Well, sometimes it's direct assault. We've heard of cases where people are beaten or killed or cut or stabbed. A couple of people have had their hands chopped off. There have been reported sexual assaults. People have been arrested, or even just the threat of death. And one of the latest things is people are being cyberbullied or cyber attacked, trying to get their data, trying to attack their systems. And then there are these nuisance lawsuits. Oh, you spoke up against us? We're going to throw a lawsuit against you and force you to spend all of your money and all of your time defending yourself against this lawsuit.
And that's where the Goliath versus David comes in, because these are very deep pocketed interests. They can keep you in court forever.
They can.
Let's talk about this. I had this feeling of the Caped Crusader riding in toward the end of the article. There's some encouragement that the Environmental Law Alliance worldwide is out there. Tell me a little bit about them.
Yeah, ELAW is a great organization based in Oregon, but they have pieces of the puzzle all over the world. They bring in fellows from countries all over the world where people are working on these environmental issues, and they partner with attorneys all over the place, and they have a number of tools in place. First of all, just the law is a great tool, but they connect people with a number of other cyber tools or strategies or ways that they can protect their data, protect their identities, protect themselves. And otherwise give them the resources they need to stay safe. Mm-hmm. It's not guaranteed, but it's better than nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's talk about any groups that maybe we can alert within the United States that this is something that needs their repeated, consistent attention. Do you see some of the organizations that are working in a more directly in the United States area that might be interested in getting word about this?
That's a good question. I know there are a couple of smaller groups that would probably help. There's a great group called Green Latinos, and their big thing is trying to connect activists around the country and say, look, you're not alone. Other people are doing this too. Learn from each other. And I think that's an important thing. And granted, in this political climate, it's probably something we should all be a little bit concerned about.
And I think, too, that we have to realize that some of the mechanisms that are being used against environmental activists can be used in their favor as well. If they're going to be cyberbullied, we've all got computers. Almost all of us have computer access. I mean, there are areas where even the largely disempowered can band together and fight back.
Right. And, I think journalists are starting to embrace a lot of these tools to help whistleblowers get out there and be anonymous or at least have their identity protected and have their information flow. So a lot of the environmental organizations, environmental journalism organizations, and the journalism organizations have been building these things and spreading the word about them. So this is something that a lot of people – there are tools out there that a lot of people can use.
John, you made yourself available on very short notice, and I'm grateful for that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You can find this article that we cited. In fact, I'll link it at thebradblog.com. I'll link that to therevelator.org. The article is entitled Murder and Intimidation of Environmental Activists Hits Record Levels. John, take care, and thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next on the Bradcast, freedom from Facebook, a consummation devoutly to be wished. I'm Angie Corbo. This is the Bradcast.
You don't own me. I'm not just one of your many tools.
It's the broadcast. I'm Angie Coiro. A couple different things that we're looking at this hour. They're kind of getting lost in the news, and one is the continued assault on reproductive rights for women. Who else to talk to for a full roundup except who's with Jody Jacobson, who is the editor-in-chief of Rewire.news. As promised, I'm going to pick up here on Facebook. There is more than one move afoot to regulate the website. Some people aim to break it up. Some people go so far as to want to declare it a public utility. The Freedom from Facebook group, which is a project of Open Markets, has kept a tally of all the ways that Facebook has crossed the line. And that's from its memo that hit the news earlier this year, expressing essentially complete amorality when it comes to what news it will perpetuate, to Cambridge Analytica, and onward beyond that. Now, let me put my bias out right here. I think Facebook could be awesome. I think it could do a great deal of service for the communities, and as well as just being fun. And I really believe that at the same time, they could be profitable. I don't think one obviates the other. But this hands-off, dare I say, libertarian take on fake news and the damage it does, and they're bungling one opportunity after another to fix the problems, it makes it look like it has no part in their ambitions or plans to be a better citizen. Case in point. Right now, there are bereaved parents from Sandy Hook who have an article up at The Guardian addressing the Alex Jones material and others that paint the murder of children at Sandy Hook as a staged government hoax. And this has been going on since the day it happened. YouTube finally pulled the plug on some Alex Jones videos. Facebook, as I mentioned earlier this hour, dragged its feet, but now they're doing a little something about it. But how much more pain are they okay with inflicting on others in the name of hands-off distribution of information? So we're going to check into Freedom from Facebook. It's a project of Open Markets, and for that we bring on its executive director, Barry Lynn. Barry, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So I'm on the emailing list for Freedom from Facebook, and it directs to a number of important things today. One is a long list of everything that Facebook has done when they could have done just the opposite in protecting people's privacy, in trying to make sure the news that goes out is true, accurate, doesn't hurt people. Tell me about the position of Freedom from Facebook on all of this.
Well, I mean, the basic idea is that, Facebook... it has become, as you said, Facebook is this terrific service. It's this terrific connector of people, the internet itself is a terrific connector of people. That's what it was built to do. But Facebook sort of makes it even easier. It gives you all these tools in which to keep track of people, track of information, and tell people what's going on in your life. And that's all a good thing. And that's a very 21st century thing, and that's something that we want to make sure sort of continues to exist for people. But as you mentioned, there's a bunch of problems with Facebook. One of them is their business model. Their business model relies on them basically snooping on you, keeping track of you, trying to figure out what your secrets are, and then taking those secrets and then using them to manipulate you through to highly targeted advertising. That's how they make their money. Remember, it's like they almost every single dollar of revenue at the company comes from selling advertising. That's $40 billion last year. And so their business model is we think is the wrong business model for this particular technology. We like the technology. We don't like the business model. So what we stand for, what we think is that should happen is that, regulators should come in and work with Facebook or force Facebook to change their business model while preserving Facebook so that it's still there for all the people who want to use it and continues to do all of the great things that we've come to love.
Let me push back on that, because what you'll hear, there are two fronts of response to that we hear all the time. One is that what we're looking at as invasion of privacy is actually an amalgamation of data that doesn't mean that you personally, Barry Lynn, have your data out there on Facebook for all the advertisers to see. You're one tiny piece in a massive puzzle that really won't be traced back to you. And the second argument, I'll let you hit both of these. The second argument we hear is that this is why Facebook is free. This is why you can find the ant you never knew you had, because it's free and the business model of advertising pays for you to be there and find your auntie.
Yeah, you know, I mean, those are those are both reasonable arguments. But the problem that we see, there's a couple of primary problems that we see with Facebook. One is that as we saw with Cambridge Analytica, they actually don't do a good job of keeping your privacy private. I mean, keeping your secrets private. You know, their system is not, they did not build a system that is secure. And that means that, theoretically, the system is designed to ensure that your data, your information gets blended into other people's information, kind of like a securitized mortgage back in the day, if we remember what those were like, right? So, but in actual fact, they just leave the door wide open and people get to look just right at your own information. People who are not even as trustworthy as the folks at Facebook. So that's one of the problems. Two, the second, is that they have kind of left the back door open to people like, Russian democracy hackers, to people who are trying to, sort of stoke anger among Americans, set Americans fighting against each other, people of the same community fighting against each other because of race or whatever reasons. And it's like, they have not done a good job of closing the back door to ensure that these sort of democracy hackers are kept out. And then the third thing, and this is what I wrote about just yesterday in the Guardian, is that because they have this business model that relies on advertising, what they do day to day is they divert advertising that should go to trustworthy sources of journalism, to the New York Times, to the Wall Street Journal, to the Guardian. And they take that advertising and they divert it away from those trustworthy sources of journalism into their own pockets. We just saw this week the Daily News lay off half of its staff in New York, local reporters. Mm-hmm. And it's like, why did they have to do that? It's because Facebook and Google are diverting the advertising in their own pocket. So the problems are multiple with Google, Facebook, and Amazon. We have simple tools that will allow us to fix the problem without getting rid of Facebook, without getting rid of Google, so we continue to enjoy the real benefits from this.
You know, I have to commend you on one of the lines that you used in that article in The Guardian. The citizens of the world's democracies face a choice. We can allow Google and Facebook to continue to strangle half our free press to death and turn the rest into cowed pets. I did think there was a certain lyricism to that. One of the things that we're up against is that the whole concept of monopoly has changed from the days that monopoly legislation was written and became law. And that was once upon a time. Monopoly is focused on one product, be it power, be it journalism, be it a food chain, whatever. And our monopolies that we're seeing now, they're multifaceted. You don't say Amazon and say you are the only mail order system in the world. They've got fingers in every pie. And I think isn't that part of the problem with trying to break Facebook up is that, A, they have so many fingers in so many pies, and B, that's not what the law addresses.
No, actually, I mean, the law, we actually have laws on the books right now that allow us to fix Facebook and make it safe for everybody.
Really?
We have, traditionally, part of it is just like people understanding what Facebook actually is. Facebook is, in many respects, it's like a 21st century version of AT&T, the telephone company. And in the 20th century, with AT&T, we had these laws. One of the laws was, you shall not listen in on the phone calls of the people who are using your system. Two, you shall not use that information, any information that you glean whatsoever about your customers, to advertise anything to them. What does Facebook do? Facebook, it connects people. It's like AT&T, but with extra benefits, extra capabilities. Yet their business model is precisely listening in on your phone call and then selling you things, manipulating you to sell you things. Yet, you know, taking your information and using it to manipulate you. So it's like if we just go back and we just look at laws that are on the book that apply that we apply to telecommunications firms, to AT&T, we apply those exact same laws to Facebook, most of the problem goes away. Now, you raise this issue of, you know, Facebook right now, they say it's free. You know, they have 150 million people, users in the United States. You know, if every one of those users paid, you know, $3 or $5 a month, you know, you would end up with, they would end up with almost as much revenue per year as they do now through their advertising model. And they would have a sufficient money to make sure that the system is the most, is the best, most, you know, world-class system of communications in the 21st century. And they would do it without having to mine your data, to suck out your secrets from your mind and then use them to manipulate you. So it's like,
you know, I'll tell you, I actually have kind of mixed feelings about that, and I'll tell you why. I don't think Facebook is necessary to a full and vibrant life. So let me just acknowledge that up front. But once you start putting a price on something that is so integrated into society, aren't you starting to get into the realm of, again, the digital haves and have-nots?
You know, I mean, it's like if we, as a society, this is actually, that's a great question. The thing is like, you know, but it's the same, like cable, you know, it's like cable, there's a price. And then, you know, certain communities may, you know, sort of work to provide cable to people of lesser means. You know, electricity has a price, I know here in Washington, there are various programs to ensure that poor people actually pay less for their electricity. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if we actually say that, you know, that as a society that we want people of lesser means to be able to access this system, then there's all kinds of ways that we can do that. And Facebook, I mean, you know, they could also, you know, as long as they're doing it in public, as long as we see why they're, how and why they're discriminating, if they say, you know, people under this level, all students get Facebook for free, all people over the age of 65 get Facebook for free. You know, as long as the discrimination is done by class and is done in public, then, we can, as a society, we can say, hey, that makes sense. So I think there's a lot of ways to deal with all of these problems. But the key thing is we have to understand is that there is never before in our society have we ever let any network monopoly, be it a railroad, be it a telephone company, be it a telegraph company, be it the electrical company, we never, ever let any previous network monopoly manipulate us the way Google and Facebook do. And because we have all of these different regimes to regulate all of those previous network monopolies, what we have is a great body of tools that we can use when we set out to figure out how to make Facebook safe for Americans in the 21st century, when we set out to figure out how to make Google safe for Americans in the 21st century.
Before I let you go, I have one more question, and that's about what we've seen. Okay, I'm going to be biased here. What we've seen as some half-hearted efforts on behalf of the American government to take a look at what's happening with Facebook. I think any of us who took hope that part of Congress was going to have Jeff Zuckerberg there in person and answer their questions, our hopes were pretty quickly dashed as to how effective that was going to be, even in the moment, let alone long-term effect. So what do we see that indicates any hope that this is being taken seriously as an issue for the American people on behalf of our government?
You know, actually, we paid a lot of attention to the hearings, the Cambridge Analytica hearings on Capitol Hill in the House and the Senate back in April. We watched both of those hearings. We watched every question. Some of our questions were asked by members of the Senate, members of the House. And what we can tell you is that that's not at all the end of the story. the people and the members and their staffers, when they opened up that box and they saw what's inside Facebook, it terrified them. They are not by any means done. As dysfunctional as the Congress has been in recent years, the one thing they are, that both people from the Republican side and the Democratic side agree on, is the need to deal with Facebook and Google, with fake news and this invasion of our privacy and this manipulation of our minds and this theft of the advertising dollars that should be going to trustworthy sources of journalism. There is bipartisan agreement about this, and these guys will, and these women, these men and women in Congress and the Senate, they will be back. I guarantee you that.
I'm going to end on that hopeful note, because we don't get too many of those these days. Barry Lynn, Executive Director of the Open Markets Institute, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's a wrap on the broadcast. Brad and Desi have enjoyed a day off so much that they're going to take another one. I'm Angie Caro, and I will be back with you at that time. Until then, good luck, world.
I can't stand this.